Jim Mars, award-winning journalist, has more than 30 years' experience with several Texas newspapers. In 1999, he began a course on UFOs, perhaps one of the first university-level UFO courses in the nation. He has investigated the U.S. Army's remote viewing program. He has looked into the UFOs, alien agenda, the JFK story. He's Jim Mars, and he's back on Coast to Coast. Jim, how are you?
Hey, George, it's always good to be with you.
Likewise, I'm looking forward to this. And how did things go in Nashville at the Dreamland Festival with Whitley and Linda Moultonhow and William Henry?
Well, once I got there, my flight was canceled.
No!
Yeah, on Friday. And I spent all day at DFW Airport being run from one gate to the other. Started off at C3, and then they told me to go to C39. So figure out how long I had to traipse through that airport.
Oh, my God.
But I got to tell you, George, in fact, I finally just got disgusted and went home. And I called William Henry, told him what had happened, and yeah, I could hear the begging in his voice. He didn't really say anything, and I suddenly realized there's people there waiting for me. So I got up the next morning and rushed to DFW Airport, and this time I got off, and this time I actually made it, and I got a standing ovation just for being there.
Did you get there in the nick of time?
In the nick of time. But I want to tell you that, like last year, this Dreamland Festival was absolutely amazing. The people there, the questions were good. The people were sharp. Everybody seemed to have a good time. There was young folks. There was old folks. It was really quite an exhilarating experience.
I like what Whitley and Ann do. You know, we had them as guests in Vancouver, British Columbia. I had a speech up there for our affiliate there, and we brought Whitley and Ann up there, and we did a segment with them. And those two have such chemistry with each other.
Right. They really do. And another thing, too, I think a lot of people may think that Whitley is strictly a UFO alien guy, but I want to tell you, he is not a one-trick pony. He knows a lot about a lot of things.
And he has a wry sense of humor, too. The more I'm with him, the more I like him and the more I understand him.
Right, right. But I've got to tell you, the closest I believe I ever came to having a UFO encounter, I was in the presence of Whitley Strieber. And I got to tell you, George, if there's any person I've ever known who may indeed have been in contact with ETs, it's Whitley.
Yeah, absolutely. Jim, let's talk a little bit before we get in. You know, we got a long 3-hour show with you tonight, and we're going to cover a lot of things here. But tell me about, you know, the one thing I have never talked with you about, and that is, who is Jim Mars? Because, I mean, you go way back.
What
happened? Well, I don't mean that far
back. I'm not really an old fogey. I just look like one.
I mean, it's not that you were at the Civil War investigating that.
Well, actually, I have been, you know. you know, that's something a lot of people don't really know. Years ago, I used to go out and hit that little white ball around with a stick, you know. I think they call it golf, as I remember. And I was a big golfer. And then the newspaper I was working for sent me out to cover a story about Civil War reenactors. And I told those guys, I said, well, look, I don't want to go stand on a sideline and watch you guys do what you're doing. I said, in fact, I've got an old cap and ball percussion pistol and an old leather vest. And they said, well, you know, come on, you just go out there with us. And I got out on the field, and the cannons were going off, and the cavalry was thundering down the field, and the smoke was hanging everywhere. And I just went, wow, forget golf, man. I like shooting Yankees better. So I've been a Civil War reenactor off and on over the years. So I've actually done that, too.
You have, and I didn't even know that. How about that?
And you know what? I know it sounds pretty silly. I'll be the first to admit it's pretty silly, but it's not any sillier than hitting that little ball around with a stick. But it's really amazing, George, because when my kids were younger, it's a family sport. You know, we'd go out and pitch our tent, and my wife and I and my daughters, and we'd all dress up, and you learn history, you learn to camp, you learn to take care of yourself out in the field, you know, and you learn tactics, and it's really been a fun, amazing experience.
There's a group up near Springfield, Illinois, and they do reenactments as well.
Been there.
And man, they love this thing. They love doing that.
Well, it's all over the country, and of course, when you get into the areas like Springfield and up in towards Virginia and stuff, they have massive people. They've had reenactments at Gettysburg that have had as many as 25,000 reenactors.
That is a lot.
That's a lot.
That is a lot.
Let me
tell you something.
That's not counting the crowd.
If I stumbled into that happening, I would think I'm time traveling. Something's happened. I've gone through a portal.
You do. You really do. If you get in the middle of it, it's very easy to just lose contact. You know, it's just, like I said, the cannons are going off and the powder smoke's hanging in the air and troops are charging and officers are barking commands. And I mean, it starts getting very real, except for the danger, which is the good part. But I got to tell you, and your listeners are going to love this one. Here's a story. This didn't happen to me, but this happened to one of my fellow reenactors. And he went to Gettysburg, okay? And it got to be evening time. And he was all dressed up in his uniform and his musket and everything. And it seems like there was something he wanted to get out of his car, but the cars were parked, you know, way the heck away. So he went trooping off by himself and was going along this little ridge heading to try to get to his car. And he saw another guy coming towards him. And this guy's all in uniform and got his musket and everything. So, you know, he figures another reenactor, you know. So he says, "Hey, how's it going?" The guy says, "Okay." And they, you know, stopped and just had very short little time and very, just a few words, you know, nice night, you know, just pleasantries. And my friend got looking at this guy, and he was really skinny, you know, and his uniform didn't hang very well. And he's thinking, man, surely he could have bought a better outfit than that, you know. And then he started getting this creepy feeling like, man, there's something weird about this guy. So he says, "Well, you know, good night." And he decided he's moving on. So he took about 10 steps or whatever away, and then he turned and looked back, and there's nobody there.
Wow.
Yeah, had a little encounter there.
Hey, Jim, all of us have gone through a metamorphosis in our life where something happens and it changes us. It changes our belief system. We go from saying, you know what, governments won't do this to their own people. And then we begin to mature. We begin to see things that we never saw before. In your case, was there anything specific that got you to start thinking the other way?
I can't think of any great epiphany, but I think I started getting my head turned around in the fall of 1972 because I'd been keeping very close tabs on the Watergate situation as it was developing. And prior to that, of course, I had been digging into the Kennedy assassination, and it became very obvious there was a huge cover-up going on at the level of the federal government. And, you know, but at that point, like most every other American, you know, no, it can't be our government. I mean, you know, we're the land of the free, the home of the brave. We won World War II, you know, it can't be that. But in the fall of 1972, when one of the Watergate burglars came out and blurted out to the judge that he was actually working for the creep, the committee to reelect the president, and it suddenly hit me that, you know, the president of the United States could and did lie to us and engage in essentially criminal activity.
Yep.
And, of course, that is what proved to be true, and Nixon was forced to resign under threat of impeachment. Look how far we've come. I mean, he was involved in a burglary and a cover-up and all kinds of skullduggery. And of course, then look what Bill Clinton got actually impeached for, you know. I don't know. But that was kind of an epiphany for me. I began to realize that just because you have a high federal office and just because you may even be a high elected official does not mean you will not commit criminal acts and evil deeds.
High crimes and misdemeanors.
That's right.
And, you know, I think for me, Jim, it was at that age of 13 when Kennedy was killed.
Right.
And, you know, I remember distinctly where I was. I was in English class. My teacher came in, Mrs. Leonard, and she was crying and sobbing, and nobody knew what happened. I mean, we're 13-year-old kids. And she said, the president has been shot. And it didn't sink in then. But then when I went home and I saw my parents crying and upset, I begin to realize that there's something strange here.
Yeah.
And even at that age, you know, when I was just listening to the reports that Oswald did it and, you know, fired off these shots mm-hmm. from the school book depository, it struck me as being very peculiar.
Really?
It really did. Yeah, at that young age.
Yeah, you actually smelled a rat right then.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and the rat's bigger, I think, now, don't
oh,
you?
Oh, yeah, well, yeah, of course. There's so much out now. Excuse me. Oh, man, I've got the sinuses here late at
okay.
night.
Okay. You got a little glass of water by you? You're
yeah,
all set
I got
there?
Some water over here. No, okay. the thing that I was the same way, except I was a little bit older and I'd had a little bit of experience. I was 63. I'd have been 20 years old. I was in college. I was already on a degree plan for journalism. So, you know, right away I'm going, wow, this is a big story and it's right here in my backyard. Plus, I don't know if I ever told you this, but I actually met Jack Ruby. I was in his club.
Yeah. Tell me about this again, though.
Well, I prove this because I got a photograph of me dancing with one of his strippers, Kathy Kay, on the stage of the Carousel Club that was taken about a month before the Kennedy assassination. But hey, okay, since I can prove it, I was in his club, and since I was there in Dallas, since I was in that whole little arena, so to speak, boy, I could tell you some really good tales, couldn't I? And yeah, you'd probably have to believe me. But I'm going to be honest. I'm always honest. All I do is try to tell the truth. I went to his club because it was one of the only clubs that was open after hours and when all the things was happening. And let me explain something. Jack Ruby's Carousel Club, you had to go up these long flight of stairs. And I can remember some of my fraternity brothers said, hey, if you ever want to get into high-stakes poker game, go into Dallas and go look up Jack Ruby. And then in almost the same breath, they'd say, but, hey, be very careful. He's connected to the underworld.
Uh-huh.
At that time, see, this is what people, especially younger researchers, don't even understand. At that time, especially down in Texas, we'd never heard of the mafia. We didn't know what the mafia was. You know, nobody had ever heard that term. That term really didn't get into the public until Joe Valachi was brought to Washington by Bobby Kennedy and forced to testify and started outlining the hierarchy of the mafia. And another thing people don't realize is now I had been in college and being aware of politics and being a pretty heavy reader, I was vaguely aware of the CIA, but most people at that time were not even aware of the CIA.
That's true.
It was pretty much like the NSA today. They kind of hear about it, but they don't really know what it is. Just know it's a secret government organization. So the truth of the matter is that, and let me tell you this about Jack Ruby's club. Yes, he had strippers, but it actually was, believe it or not, a fairly nice club by today's standards. For one thing, the strippers didn't go past two-piece bathing suit. Now, in fact, you can see more skin on primetime television these days than you could on Jack Ruby's stage. But yeah. The main thing, George, is it wasn't just a strip joint. They had a live band. They had an announcer. They had acts. There were, I don't know.
It was a nightclub.
It was a nightclub. Yeah, exactly. And the Carousel Club and the Collie Club, which was run by Abe Weinstein, was kind of right across the parking lot. They were kind of right next to each other, and after about 9 o'clock at night, they were about the only action in Dallas, Texas at that time.
Well, there were so many people, Jim, that wanted JFK removed. I mean, Hoffa
a bunch
wanted.
Of them were in Dallas.
Yeah, Hoffa wanted them. All of them. I mean, they all wanted. And I don't know what's going on, but over the last two weeks, people have been sending me YouTube video of this of the driver Greer.
Yeah.
And I got to tell you, I can't see him. I see him turning around, but I don't see a gun in his hand.
Now, please, let me take this opportunity to try to get a little rational thought and truth out there, okay? Nobody ever mentioned anything about the driver shooting Kennedy until the mid-'80s, okay? And a researcher in California named Lars Hansen viewed a very third, fourth, bad, grainy copy of the Zapruder film, and he kind of thought, well, wow, saw a little flash, saw a little light. He says, I think the driver may have turned and shot him. And that spread around, and certain people picked up on that and started pushing it along.
And the late Bill Cooper did it, didn't
Bill
he?
Yeah, he was selling videos. I actually sent off to find out what the hell he was talking about. And the video, it was a VHS tape at that time, and it had three or four or five, half dozen frames of the Zapruder film, and they were, some of them were so bad and so ill copied that they didn't even have any color in them. Okay, now let me set it all straight. The driver did not turn and shoot Kennedy. Okay, now first off, let's just use our head. If that had happened, surely one of the 20 people standing within, you know, 10 or 15 feet of the car would have at least at one point said, oh, by the way, the driver turned and shot him.
Exactly.
The Secret Service, you know, even if they'd been in on it, they would have whispered about that. It would have been a rumor that would have gone all around Washington, even if they tried to cover it up. And, of course, nobody would have said that officially, but there would have been scuttlebutt about that for years. No, none of that.
Even though we believe there was a conspiracy, it wasn't that one.
It wasn't that one. And here's another thing, too. I knew Nellie Connelly, John Connelly's wife, and she was a wonderful and sweet Southern lady. And I can't for a minute believe that if she sat in that car and saw the driver shoot Kennedy, that she wouldn't have said something to somebody.
Okay? Yeah, absolutely.
Same thing for Jackie, I suppose. You know, what is she? Is she not going to say that to anybody? I mean, but then, so what are these people seeing? Okay, if you take a somewhat blurry, and the thing that's on YouTube, by the way, they say this is one of the finest copies of this Zapruder film, and yet it's not. Okay, it's pretty blurry, actually. And if you...
And the more they open, blow it up, the harder it is to see.
The blurrier it gets.
Yeah.
And if you front load somebody, it's a term I learned from the remote viewers, okay, if you front load somebody that, hey, the driver shoots Kennedy, and they start looking for that, then they see that, okay? But let me tell you what they're actually seeing. Back in those days, the men all wore hair grease. Brill cream, a little dab to you.
Yeah.
Remember that, George?
Sure do.
So they all slicked their hair down, and Roy Kellerman and Greer, the driver, all had their hair slicked down. And so if you'll really watch, what you see is that this L-shaped highlight, which seems to be a pistol, is actually the sunlight glinting off of their greased
heads.
Hair. And it does do this just as Greer turns to look over his right shoulder. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, and he does look, because the president's been shot. What the heck's going on here? He turns around to see what's going on.
Exactly. But now, I will now. Now, here's where we do get to some suspicious stuff. Greer testified to the Warren Commission that he never looked back, and that he didn't even know the assassination had taken place until Kellerman...
Now, that's weird. We clearly can see him turning.
Of course. He said he didn't know anything had happened until Kellerman next to him said, get out of here, we've been hit. Now, let's put that in a broader context. There were films of the motorcade. A fellow by the name of Orville Nix took a film from the south side of Elm Street.
Let's pick that up, Jim, when we come right back. I want to talk a little bit about the JFK assassination this half hour. Then we'll get into the Nazis and flying saucers and some of this incredible technology and what we know about it today. We'll be back in a moment with Jim Mars on Coast to Coast AM. And with our guest tonight, Jim Mars, Jim's website is linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com, jimmarrs.com. Take a look at some of the many things he has done. His recent books, The Terror Conspiracy, Rise of the Fourth Reich, Alien Agenda, Above Top Secret, Psy Spies, Rule by Secrecy, Crossfire, The Plot That Killed Kennedy, so much more. We'll be back with Jim Mars in just a moment at Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Jim, let's spend about 20 minutes just talking about JFK, and the next hour we'll get into the flying saucers and the Nazis as well. So you were saying that there was a new film or something else that was found?
No, they put this thing up and brought up this old wheeze about the driver shooting Kennedy, and it's a major distraction because, you know, there's still a lot of people out there that listen to this, and it's simply not true. Not that there wasn't a conspiracy, of course. In fact, some of the actions of the Secret Service that day are pretty suspicious. Orville Nix was shooting film from the south side of Elm Street, and as the shots rang out, you can see the brake lights come on Kennedy's car, and it slows to almost a complete stop. And contrary to his testimony, the driver Greer, who told the Warren Commission he never looked back, obviously, and as a proof of him, you see him look back over his right shoulder, mm-hmm. looking right back at Kennedy, and it's only after the fatal headshot that he faces forward, and the brake lights come off, and the car speeds away. Well, this is total violation of Secret Service regulations and policies, which state that at the first sign of trouble, you hit the gas and you get out of there. Okay? He hit the brake. And then, of course, there's the story of the Secret Service agents assigned to Kennedy who the night before, instead of getting a good night's sleep, were up till maybe 5 in the morning or later over in Fort Worth at Pat Kirkwood's cellar drinking alcohol. And there were more lies there. Pat Kirkwood was told to testify that he didn't serve alcohol. And other people said, oh, you can't get alcohol in the cellar. Well, it's simply not true. Yes, technically and legally, he wasn't supposed to serve alcohol, and you couldn't go in there and buy a drink. But if you were anybody, a newspaper reporter, a city official, a cop, you go in there and he'd give you free alcohol. Okay.
That's right.
And how do I know that? Because I got some of that myself by hanging out with some of the reporters there from the Star-Telegram. And plus, I a few years later, I got to be good friends with Pat Kirkwood, and he acknowledged that Kennedy's Secret Service agents were all in there drinking salty dicks, okay, and which was vodka and grapefruit juice. And I find this really interesting because, of course, the next day when the shots rang out in Dealey Plaza, his Secret Service men were just really slow to react. They were just, you can look in the photographs and the films, they were kind of like looking around like, what was that? Okay? And I find this really interesting when you go back and realize that at the Abraham Lincoln assassination, there was a guard outside of his door at the theater, but the guard had gone off to get a drink. So I think maybe that's why that the Secret Service in 1963 had a policy said that any time you're traveling with the president, that's counted as travel time and you're not supposed to drink. And yet nothing was ever done to these people because the head of the Secret Service said, no, let's don't punish them because they feel bad enough about losing the president. I don't know about that, but that's what happened.
Jeez. Well, will we ever get to the bottom line here, Jim, with this JFK assassination?
Oh,
will we
sure.
ever know? You think so?
Yeah, we know it now. If people would simply take the time and the trouble to read all of the available information and not just read the headlines in the corporate mass media, okay? Here's what we know, and here's what everybody that studied the case can pretty much agree on, except for a few holdouts, people with their heads in the sand, or paid disinformation agents. If Oswald acted, and that's a huge if, he certainly did not act alone. Ergo, there was a conspiracy. This conspiracy is still being covered up to this very day, and it's being covered up at the level of the federal government of the United States, okay? And this is what, and this can be proven. There was destruction of evidence, suppression of evidence, fabrication of evidence, alteration of evidence, and intimidation of witnesses. These are all criminal offense in any murder case. If you kill somebody and you tell me and I don't go turn you in, I'm an accomplice after the fact, right?
That's right.
Okay. So this cover-up can be laid right at the feet of Lyndon Johnson, his successor, and his next-door neighbor and buddy, J. Edgar Hoover, who at that time headed the FBI.
And hated Kennedy.
Both of them hated Kennedy. And Johnson was so ambitious that he gave up his powerful Senate seat to be kind of a nothing vice president under Kennedy, and he told people it put me one step closer. Well, he finally took that step on November the 22nd. So what I'm telling you is we now know what happened. Lyndon Johnson, J. Edgar Hoover, although we'd probably never be able to prove if they actually had foreknowledge or ordered it or knew anything about it, what can be proven is they covered up the truth afterwards, which makes them accessories after the fact, and they are guilty of the Kennedy assassination.
That's pretty strong, Jimmy.
Well, hey, I'm just going by the legal terms and what we've executed people in Texas in a murder case when the facts of the case clearly showed that they didn't pull the trigger. They were just having to be there, or they covered up the crime. Okay? That's the way our legal system is supposed to work.
Have you investigated anything that has to do with Daddy Bush, George Bush, being in Texas at the time of the assassination? And that seems to be popping up all the time. But have you ever looked at that angle?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. He was there. In fact, I have information he was in Dallas the night before the Kennedy assassination in conversation with Richard Nixon, who also was in Dallas. And I have reason to believe J. Edgar Hoover was in Dallas. I mentioned that years ago on a radio station in Fort Worth, and a lady called in and said, well, I was talking about this party at this home at Clint Murchison's house the night before the assassination, and according to Madeline Brown, who was a kind of a girlfriend of Johnson, she said Nixon was there, Johnson was there, J. Edgar Hoover was there, and I really asked her about George Bush Sr., but she didn't really know. But then you have to understand that George Bush Sr., at that time, Texas was run by the Democratic Party, and Bush was a Republican. And there was
right.
only, you could count the number of Republicans in Texas on one hand at that time. So it's understandable why she might not have recognized him or known him. But I also interviewed a man who was also at the Adolphus Hotel on the night before the assassination, and he ran into George Bush and actually had words with him, and he knew George Bush. And George Bush has never been able to adequately explain where he was.
What was he doing then in 1963?
He was a Texas oil man.
He was just an oil man at that
time. Yeah, well, not just an oil man. First, you have to understand that his father, Prescott Bush, this senior senator from Connecticut, who we'll probably mention later on when we get to the rise of the Fourth Reich, helped create the CIA. And I am still in touch with a black ops CIA pilot who said that back in 1961, he was flying arms and ammunition for the CIA to the Bay of Pigs invaders. And he said they were using oil companies as fronts. Okay, yeah, we're shipping oil equipment, and actually as machine guns and rifles. And the House Committee pointed up that Schlumberger was one of these oil companies that they were using as a front. And so back about 1991, I asked this fellow, I said, were there any other oil companies that were being used as a front to fly ammunition and arms to the Bay of Pigs invaders? And he said, yeah, I flew some for Zapata. And so, well, this was George Bush's senior's oil company. But I'm thinking, well, President Bush at that time. I said, maybe this guy is just trying to tell me something he thinks I want to hear, you know, maybe a good story. So, being a good reporter, I threw him a trick question. I said, oh, yeah, that's a Zapata Oil Company out of Houston, Texas, because everybody knew George Bush was an oil man out of Houston. And without batting an eye, he said, no, this is Zapata Drilling out of Midland, Odessa. Bingo. So once I learned this, then I got to going back and looking a little closer at the Bay of Pigs invasion. The whole operation was codenamed Zapata, which in Spanish...
Was it really?
Yes, which in Spanish means shoe. And the two ships that were damaged in the landing of the Cuban Brigade were the Barbara and the Houston.
Oh, come on. Unbelievable.
God's truth.
I believe you. I believe you. Isn't it something, Jim, Castro has outlived everybody?
He really has. And there, I couldn't even count how many times they tried to kill him.
Just truly. And I bet this guy knows so much about that assassination. I don't believe he was involved in it, but
no,
I believe he knows about it.
He does, and he's told it. But he's Castro. We can't believe him. You know, so nobody pays attention and doesn't get immediate traction.
What have you been doing lately?
Just working and traveling and trying to get over King Tut's fungus infection. I made a trip to Egypt in January and made the mistake of going into the Red Pyramid. And first you have to climb and hike halfway up this thing. I didn't like climbing a mountain. And then you climb down into this thing and you can't even stand up. You have to crouch
and
work your way one step at a time sideways. You know, so you go down into the middle of this thing. You get down in there and I was huffing and puffing and I think I must have sucked something in, because from that point on, I was not actually sick. I didn't feel bad, but I was coughing my head off.
Jim, it wouldn't be beyond them to have sprayed you with something here.
Oh, well, yeah. Well, always remember, George, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not after you.
That's exactly right. What did you think of Egypt?
It was fascinating. It was absolutely fascinating. This would probably be a discussion for another show, but the one thing I came away from, I've heard all the controversy about the dating of the Sphinx and the Great Pyramid.
Yeah.
The thing I came away unalterably convinced that the Egyptians did not build the Great Pyramid of the Sphinx.
Don't tell Zahi Hawass that.
No. We don't want to tell him that. In fact, I kept my mouth shut over there because he very graciously allowed us a private time in the Great Pyramid.
That's good. I mean,
but let me tell you, there's a little quick point here. Everywhere I went in Egypt, and they've got some fantastic stuff there, actually old stuff they moved, you know, when they built the Aswan Dam.
Yep.
and managed to put these huge, colossal pieces back together. But everywhere I went, every temple, every palace, every square inch was covered with hieroglyphics, okay? Because apparently the Egyptians were kind of like the Romans and the Nazis. I mean, they had to write down everything, you know? And yet you go into the Great Pyramid, nada, nothing. There's not any hieroglyphics in the Great Pyramid. And it just doesn't make sense to me.
No, it doesn't. And the precision, too.
The precision is just, in fact, I saw what to me were obviously saw cuts on some of those huge blocks, okay?
Oh.
Anyway, we could go on and on about that. And,
yeah,
of course, as you well know, there's a whole lot more to it than just the simple fact that there's no hieroglyphics in the Great Pyramid. There's the water erosion. Now, I will mention that.
Yeah.
On the Great Pyramid, and again, and most pronounced on the Sphinx and surrounding area, is very obvious deep vertical water erosion, where water's poured off of the side of that thing and cut grooves, vertical grooves into it. Not horizontal grooves. It wasn't sand blowing, okay? This is water erosion. And yet we know that there's not been any heavy rainfall on the Giza Plateau for more than 10,000 years. Well, it kind of leaves out the Egyptians, doesn't it?
Sure does.
But here's another thing I might point out. They are starting to brick up the sides of the pyramids. Now, why, I ask? And they said, oh, well, it's deteriorating, and we need to, you know, shore it up and make it look nice and keep it from further deterioration. And I'm thinking, yeah, you're covering up the water erosion.
That's a great story, too. I mean, this sounds like a new mystery book coming out, Jim, from you.
Well, maybe I ought to write a mystery book. You know, speaking of, I'll put in a plug. I actually have tried my hand at writing a novel, and it's going to be published later this year, probably about November, and we probably ought to have a get-together and talk about that at that
Absolutely.
Time.
Absolutely. What's the subject matter?
Well, it's entitled The Sisterhood of the Rose, and it is a story. I call it a work of faction, okay? It's fact-based fiction, and the basic story comes from a woman I know, Celeste Levesque, who said this is her past life. She remembers this. And amazingly, I've now run into at least a dozen people, some in Dallas, some in Texas, some around there, some in Arizona, some in other places, who after hearing her story say, you know, I remember that too. So isn't that wild? But anyway, so I took this as a basic story and fitted in with known historical facts. And it's all about a secret society of women who helped win World War II for the Allies and try to stop the Nazis from recovering Solomon's treasure.
Oh, I love it. There's a movie behind this one.
Oh, it would make a great movie.
Well, you know, Whitley's got some great experience with that. He can help you in that direction.
That's true.
When you're ready to go.
That's true.
I mean, everything he touches just turns to Solomon's treasure.
Isn't that right? And, hey, while I'm at it, and before I forget it, I want to make sure and let everybody know that I'm going to be appearing at the Sedona Creative Life Center on August the 8th for talking about Above Top Secret, The Real Jim Mars, Live and Uncensored. That's August the 8th, from 1 to 4 at the Sedona Creative Life Center. And I'm assuming you can get further information www.stellarproductionslive, that's STELLARPRODUCTIONSLIVE, live.com.
Perfect. Set the stage for us for next hour. Nazis and flying saucers. Tell me how we stumbled into this. What'd you find?
Well, it's amazing, but as I was researching for my latest New York Times bestseller, The Rise of the Fourth Reich, I had to go back and to figure out what's going on today, you have to go back. You know, it's like the National Archives say, the past is prologue. If you don't understand what happened in the past, then you're going to have a hard time trying to figure out what's going on today. So as I was going, it amazed me the level of technology that the Nazis got to. In fact, in my book, The Rise of the Fourth Reich, amazingly enough, I lay out all the information to show that I really believe that they developed an atomic bomb, unlike what we've been told.
They just didn't have the time to launch it, did they?
Well, I think there were two problems, George. One was they didn't really have one operational or ready to go until 1945, and by that time the Russians were closing in on one side and the Allies, the Western Allies were closing in on the other, and they had two big problems. One was, and I think the reason they didn't drop this, although I have seen a 1943 feasibility study by the Nazi Luftwaffe for an atomic bomb blast radius effect on Manhattan Island, okay? And at the end of the war, they had 40 huge bombers at a base in Norway. They were those big twin-engine Junkers 390s. They twin-engine. They were six-engine. They had three engines.
Huge
things. And one of them actually, and this is historic record, one of them actually flew transatlantic, got to within about 20 miles of New York, photographed the skyline, turned around, flew back. So they were almost had the capability, but not quite. They were still trying to build this air base in Norway when the war ended, so they didn't quite have it finished. And then they had rockets, of course, but they didn't have competent guidance systems.
Right.
The V-2 terror weapon. That what they did for guidance was to aim it at London and give it just enough fuel so it dropped down on the city.
And it had no idea where it would go. Jim, we'll be back with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Jim, if the Nazis had flying saucers, how did they get it? Did they pick up some kind of crash and retrieve it and try to back engineer it?
Okay. You're going to find this most interesting, but let me put a cap on where we left off at the end of it. I got one of the reasons why they didn't drop their nuclear bomb, which was they didn't have a reliable delivery system by the end of the war. But the main reason, I think, is because they knew that if they were to drop an atomic bomb on Paris or London or New York, it would not have ended the war. It would have ended Germany. We would have obliterated that place, right?
Yeah.
And left a no stone unturned. And so this is, that gets us into the technology swap that took place. Basically, what happened was is that top Nazis, particularly the SS, who had taken over all the means of production and all the highest technological achievements that the Nazi regime had, they swapped the U.S. technology in exchange for immunity. And we all know about Operation Paperclip and
That's right.
They brought all these Nazis over here. Okay, but we'll get to that, too. But to answer your question, it is historic fact that the Nazis had flying saucers on the drawing boards. The Schreiber, the Methane saucers. The only real question is, did they have some that could actually work? And I think if you look at all of the available information, yes, they did. Okay.
And where did they get the idea for it, Jim?
Where did they get this? Well, for years, I've heard all these rumors that they had recovered a UFO somewhere. Okay. Yeah, I heard it was in Western Poland. No, it was in Czechoslovakia. No, it was in North Africa.
Mm-hmm.
But every time me and other researchers tried to track down those stories, you always hit a dead end. It just didn't seem to happen. So this is going to really fascinate you and your readers. Before the Nazis even came into being and came to power, some of the ranking aristocrats in Germany back in, starting in the late 1800s, they were big advocates of the Theosophical Society, Madame Blavatsky, and at the time of World War One, like here and like in England, spiritualism was a big fad. And people would have seances, and they would try to contact the spirit world. And keep in mind, that was at a period of time when nobody really knew or thought about extraterrestrial things.
Right. So, and Hitler was big into the occult, right?
Big into the occult. He sent expeditions to Tibet and South America and southern France and chasing Solomon's treasure, the Ark of the Covenant, and on like that. But they were having these spiritual seances and stuff, which the early day spiritualism basically was experimenting with psychic type abilities, which, of course, was the forerunner of remote viewing, which was something that our CIA investigated and experimented with, and the U.S. Army picked it up and actually had a unit of remote viewers using psychic ability to spy on the Soviets and Chinese and any other potential enemy. Now, here's what's fascinating. Once the Cold War was over with and communism collapsed in Russia, there has just been a surge of new information, stuff that had been kept hidden because of the Cold War. And one of the things we found out was one of our top military remote viewers came into contact with some of his counterparts from the old Soviet Union. They called them extra sensors. And, of course, they were, you know, they were like comrades in arms because they had been doing that. They were psychic warriors, but on opposite sides. And it's just like old fighter pilots that get together and swap stories. Well, they got together and swapped stories. And we learned that they had picked up a lot of their psychic research from Nazi scientists who had been working on psychic matters, okay? And the reason the Soviets got it is quite simple. The American authorities at the time, they didn't believe in that stuff, so they didn't pay any attention to it. And it was the Soviets, it was the Russians who took these Nazi psychic scientists and took them into Russia and into Eastern Europe, and they continued their psychic work, which to try to counteract that led to our development of remote viewing. But now get this, George. The unit within the Nazi military that was practicing psychic experimentation was called Dr. Greenbaum, or Greenbaum in the German. It's Dr. Greenbaum, which means green tree.
Green tree.
Yeah, which they tend to think may have a Kabbalistic background, but here's the real clincher. The Dr. Greenbaum was under an umbrella program called MAJIK, M-A-J-I-K.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reason I think that's so fascinating is because you and your listeners, of course, all know that according to the rumors and the stories, there has been a group in this country since the war that was created and put in charge of keeping secret the UFO information, and early on it was known as MAJIK, M-A-J-I-C, and then became MAJIK 12, shortened to MJ-12, and then eventually, I think in an effort maybe to just to try to confuse everybody, it became MAJESTIK 12, but the earliest references are to MAJIK, M-A-J-I-C, which is the anglicized version of the German M-A-J-I-K, which was their psychic program. And just like we now know that remote viewing works, apparently, George, the Nazis were able to make contact psychically with non-human intelligences, and they began to pick up some of this incredible technology.
Now, as this was going on in Germany, were the Americans working on anything? Because Roswell didn't occur for a few years later.
That was not until 1947. And that's right. Certain people at certain levels were beginning to kind of wake up. We know about the Foo Fighters, okay? And then, of course, the great air raid of February 1942 in Los Angeles, which we now have documents purporting that they recovered unconventional aircraft in the ocean off of Los Angeles and in the San Bernardino Mountains. And here's what's really fascinating me: in one of those documents signed by George Marshall, who was chief of staff to Roosevelt, down at the bottom there's a little separate paragraph, and he said, "I've ordered a thorough search of all War Department files for any reference to unconventional aircraft dating back to 1897. And as we've talked about before in your program, 1897 was the year of the Aurora spaceship crash in Texas, which was covered in the newspapers at the time and said a large silver cigar-shaped object had crashed to Earth in Aurora, exploded into all these pieces. And about the fourth or fifth paragraph, it says the pilot was supposed to be the only one on board, and although his remains were badly disfigured, enough was recovered to show he was not an inhabitant of this world. Okay?
And his bones were stolen, right?
Oh, yeah. There's a whole huge mystery there. We could spend a whole program talking about
just
the
Aurora
spaceship
one.
Crash. Yeah. I think by 1942, they were beginning to figure out that there's something going on. But for the rank and file, for the middle management types and the colonels and the captains and the people that were not in on the know, who are not part of the families and the organizations that have been carrying these secrets for centuries, we were a much more religious country at that point. And everybody went to Sunday school, and they didn't want to believe that any of that was going on. And that's why even up into the 80s and 90s, when the CIA was working with the remote viewing, and then the Army picked it up and had a unit of remote viewers, they were running into incredible resistance from many of the authorities. I remember one of the military remote viewers told me about one time that they had been passing information to a colonel in the Pentagon, and he just got more and more curious because their information was turning out to be correct, and finally said, "I demand to know where you're getting this information." So they said, "Okay." So they told him that they were getting it psychically through the remote viewing program, and he said, "Get out of my office." He says, "I won't believe that even if you prove it to me."
Is it possible that the crashes at Roswell, because there were a couple of them, 47,
right?
Is it possible that that could have been German technology?
Well, since there's been such a mystery about it, I will have to concede that that might be possible. But, George, personally, I don't buy it, okay? I think there was something definitely unworldly about what crashed at Roswell because of the more than 700 witnesses that are now in the public record, you know. And although I'm sure you could build a convoluted argument that, well, we were testing a Nazi saucer or whatever, that nothing like that has actually been put forward. As you well know, the actual evidence from Jesse Marcel's viewing of this metal that folds out and then, you know, after you crumple it up, it folds back into its original shape and can't be cut and can't be burned, to General Exxon, who said he flew over and saw the wreckage and then was participated in flying these small alien bodies to Wright-Patterson. You know, it goes on and on and on. So, I'll concede that it might have been something like that, but I don't think so because the evidence doesn't support that.
It was funny. It was on a plane leaving from Los Angeles coming to St. Louis over the weekend. And, of course, they give you peanuts, right? And so I ripped open the little bag, and I had the peanuts, and the people next to me had their peanuts. And I crumpled the bag up, Jim, and it popped right back to its original shape. And I looked at this thing, and I thought of Roswell, and I went, this is incredible. Did we possess this kind of technology then? I don't think we did we?
I don't think so, because I can remember the what we used to call aluminum foil, and I don't recall it doing that, but I know what you're talking about, because it's funny, George. I've had the exact same experience. You know, I take a little aluminum. Yeah, I don't know what they are. Aluminum. They're real light, little, you know, almost like.
Yeah, paper. And they look like aluminum on the inside.
Metallic, but they're metallic, yeah. Okay? And you wad them up. I fold them up, pull them up, and fold them up until I get it down to something, you know, about that's quite snugly between my thumb and forefinger. And then you set it down, and it goes blip, 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 and goes right back.
Right back this year. Right back. You know, it's Roswell.
Yeah, I'm wondering, gee, where'd we get that? You know, and of course, like night vision, you know, night vision has been something desired by every military in the mm-hmm. world, you know, all through history, because up until very, very recently, when night fell, all fighting stopped, you know, because you can't see anything, and you don't want to kill you don't want friendly fire, so, you know, there'd be a raging battle during the Civil War, World War I, World War II, raging battle, but when night came, everything stopped, pretty much, because you can't see in the nighttime. And now we've got night vision. Put that green out there and you can see everything, just highlighted everything. And yet, if you don't have the goggles on, it's still dark. You can't see anything. It's a tremendous breakthrough. And if you listen to Colonel Corso, he explained how that he took alien technology from Roswell and passed it along to the industries you know, that were developing this very thing. And what I thought was funny is when he went in to show a guy some of the lenses that these aliens had, and it gave the guy the idea to start working off into another area to develop night vision. And, of course, the guy was curious. He said, where'd you get this? And Colonel Corso called him, oh, from France, you know. So, you know, and, of course, that was 60 years ago almost.
Yep.
And so, you know, if you found one of these old boys who had actually developed some of this technology, and say they met Corso one day for 1 hour, and they said, well, that's interesting, where'd you get this? And he said, from France. Well, you know, 60 years later, they're going to say, well, no, I didn't develop that from alien technology, because honestly, they don't know that.
I want to talk a little later about the secrets of Redgate and your work there, Jim. But this technology, assuming they were able to get it and they reversed it, what happened to it? Hoagland would say it turned into a black ops program. They're using it now. What do you say?
Well, I argue in my book, The Rise of the Fourth Reich, that I begin to agree with Hoagland. I think there's been a covert space program taking place on this planet. We know about the two public space programs. One was in the old Soviet Union in Russia, and the other, of course, in America. But then when you stop and look at it, they're both using Nazi scientists. I remember as a kid, the joke was the Russian and the American arguing and saying, our Nazi scientists are better than your Nazi scientists.
Yeah.
And so these Nazis, we now know, were in contact at two separate levels. They were in contact at a lower level. They found Wernher von Braun sneaking messages out of the country, all right? And they were down at El Paso, and they'd drive over the border into Mexico with no one watching over them. There was every opportunity to send letters and messages, phone calls, who knows what. So the Nazi scientists were in touch. And then at the highest levels, Wall Street, okay, the Rockefellers, the, you know, the New World Order people, and they were all in cahoots because, amazingly enough, as I point out in my book, The Rise of the Fourth Reich, the architects, two of the major architects that helped create the Third Reich in Germany was John J. McCloy, head of National City Bank, which is now Citicorp, that was the largest lender of money to Nazi Germany, and Alan Dulles, who became head of the CIA, after the war, he and his brother John Foster Dulles were attorneys for Sullivan Cromwell, that were the law firm representing the Schroeder Rockefeller Bank, which is where all the money transfer was going on. So you got high level connections, you got low level connections. So while the Russians are building all these heavy lift rockets, which allowed them to make all the first in space, they were the first to put a man in orbit, first to put Sputnik up, first to put a dog up, first to put a woman astronaut up. So they had all these heavy lift rockets. We were working on all the complex computer and guidance systems. Okay, and this is typical methodology for a secret program. You keep it compartmentalized. They had one portion of the secret. We had the other, and somewhere these Nazis and these New World Order socialists, they've got access to both sides, so they can put together a really advanced space program.
I can't figure out, Jim, this triangular-shaped object that we keep seeing around military bases in this country. Not the huge one in Phoenix, but the objects that are about 300 feet long, but they're very triangular. Police officers have seen them. A number of people have seen them. What the heck are they?
Well, they look too big to stay in the air, right?
Yes.
And they travel too slow. At the Stephenville incident at the beginning of last year, we finally got the radar data, and it showed that one of those huge objects was cruising along at 40 miles an hour. Okay, that's not airspeed. You cannot stay in the air at 40 miles an hour unless you're using some kind of superior technology. And now let's talk about the Bell, because the Nazis were working in that very area. Okay?
They were getting close if they didn't perfect it.
If they didn't perfect them, they were getting very close. And they were not using jet propulsion. Although, yes, of course, they were the first to develop the world's first jet fighter, the Messerschmitt 262. But they were on to other things. As I mentioned earlier, towards the end of the war, Heinrich Himmler and the SS began slowly taking over the entire production and research and development arm of the Nazi government. Even Albert Speer, who had been armaments minister, has written and said that, man, they were doing things he didn't even know anything about. So Hitler and Himmler and Goering and all the guys we know about, they weren't even aware of what was going on. But when we come back, I'll tell you what was going on.
All right, we'll do that. And also, we'll talk a little bit about the secrets of Redgate. That's an incredible story, too. We're with Jim Mars tonight, and he's on fire. Let's go right back to some of these secrets of the Bell and some other things, Jim. The secrets on this planet are just so overwhelming. One has to start concluding that they have this kind of technology, don't you think?
Well, absolutely. There is just so much that's been hidden from us. And believe it or not, if anybody's listening to the speech that John F. Kennedy made shortly before his death, he is blasting all this secrecy, and he said secrecy is abhorrent to a free society. And yet today, everything's secret. This is a secret, that's a secret, got to keep this secret. Now, keep in mind, George, that when I was in the Army, I actually served with military intelligence. And so I understand that there are certain secrets that you have to keep secret. I mean, you don't want to tell where our defense systems are or exactly how they work, you know, so that some enemy could confound them. But once you get past that, then there's so many things that are secret that shouldn't be secret. The Federal Reserve System, for example, which is supposed to be in charge of our money, they won't tell us where the money goes or what they're doing with it. That's ridiculous, okay? So we've just gotten into this national security state, this new American super empire, or as I call it, the Fourth Reich, because in German, Reich simply means empire. So we're the fourth big empire, and I don't think anybody argue with me that we are now the preeminent empire on the planet.
Will we ever bring this technology to the forefront, Jim?
It's going to be tough until the people demand it. But, you know, there's kind of a wake-up call going on. I've been at this game for many years now, and when I tried to talk about National Socialism coming to America, the very same people that crashed the German economy and brought in the Nazi regime are now crashing our economy, and they're bringing us into a socialistic state. And when I started talking about secret societies, when I talked about suppressed technology, everybody just kind of went, oh yeah, well, you're just a conspiracy theorist. But now that our economy is teetering, and now that you know, even Newsweek says a couple of months ago, now we're all socialists. You know, a lot of people are paying attention now.
Absolutely. And we're seeing this unfold. And that's a great analogy, too, because the kinds of people that did what they did with Germany are the same people, the same kinds of people who are doing that to us today.
Well, as I said, sometimes it's the same people.
Same families, yeah.
John J. McCloy, who was head of the City National Bank, which is now Citicorp, largest lender of money to the German to the Germany, and to then Alan Dulles and his brother John Foster operating on behalf of the Rockefeller Schroeder Bank, which Time magazine called the center of the Axis finance empire. And these helped build Hitler and the Third Reich. And then after the war, John J. McCloy became the High Commissioner of Germany and pardoned all these Nazis that he had helped fund, sent them over to the United States, where his protege, Alan Dulles, who's head of the CIA, whitewashed their Nazi backgrounds and started putting them to work in our military-industrial complex. And, George, the problem there was that when we got their technology, we also got their philosophy, National
Yes.
Socialism.
Exactly. And their baggage.
And their baggage, absolutely. And there was nobody watching over the store, because we were all so elated that the war was over, and everybody, you know, thank God we don't have to fight a war, and everybody went back, and they were too busy trying to, you know, get their family life back going, trying to get a college education, and trying to, you know, go on with their life, that nobody was paying attention to this infusion of National Socialist into this country. And now it's coming home to roost.
Is the rise of the Fourth Reich still available?
Absolutely. In fact, the soft cover edition is now available, so at a much reduced price. I don't know what they're asking for it here.
Boy, Amazon discounts like crazy, doesn't it?
That's true. Yeah. Okay, it's $15, and yeah, you go to Amazon or you go to one of these wholesale places or book club or something, you can probably get it for under $10.
Absolutely.
And people need to read this, because if you don't understand what's happened in the past, then you don't understand what's happening today. For example, in 1931, Germany was a republic, okay? And the Weimar Republic, and it was experiencing a kind of a resurgence of freedom, democracy. And then one bank failed in Vienna. And then the people who had been funding Germany, J.P. Morgan, who had set up his guys had set up the Dawes Plan and the Young Plan, which was trying to take over German business and driving people to radical politicians like Hitler. And then John J. McCloy and Citibank pulls the funding, and all of a sudden Germany is put into hyperinflation. Their dollar collapsed, And we've all heard the stories of how they were having to take wheelbarrow loads of money just to buy a loaf of bread. And that, and up until then, the German people, some of the most educated and cultured in the world, had pretty much disdained Hitler and the Nazis. They thought they were just kind of some radical bunch and didn't pay much attention to them. But when their economy collapsed and when their country was thrown into chaos, then they turned to Hitler because he said, give me the power, I'll take care of this. So they did, and we see what came of that. And unfortunately, what I see happening, and of course with variations, is the same thing here.
And then back to Prescott Bush for a moment. You'd mentioned him last hour. He was one of the directors of the Union Banking Corporation, which was an investment bank, which was seized in 1982. 1942, helping the Nazis.
Exactly. He was basically a financial front man for the Nazis. And, of course, what you just said was absolutely true. It's on the record. And as I was writing my book, The Rise of the Fourth Reich, and going over it with the editor in New York, and I had, at some later date, after detailing all that about Union Banking and how he's prosecuted under the Trading with the Enemies Act, stripped of his holdings, I referred to him as a Nazi financier, and my editor said, well, you can't say that. And I said, well, wait a minute, what else do you call somebody who's prosecuted by the government of the United States for being a financial front man for Hitler and the Nazis? You know, what else do you call him? Now, here's a good one for you, George, and this is just kind of a throwaway in the Rise of the Fourth Reich book, and so you may have missed it. Why wasn't there a more press, more coverage, why wasn't there more publicity about the fact that this prominent American banker was acting as a financial front man for Hitler? And by the way, it wasn't just Union Banking Corporation. He also sat on the board of directors of the Hamburg America Steamship Company, which they later identified as the main conduit of Nazi spies, money, saboteurs, and every propaganda that was coming into the United States. So why wasn't more of that made about that? You know, and why wasn't he put in jail and prison instead of just having his hand slapped and his stuff in Union Banking Corporation taken away, all of his contacts there? Well, it's because in 1941, the year before he was prosecuted, Prescott may have been a Hitler's front man, but he wasn't stupid. He was instrumental in creating the United Service Organization, the USO. And for any of your listeners who watch the old war movies or who lived through it, you know that in World War II, Korea, Vietnam, it was, you know, when I was in the Army, we loved the USO because that's where you go to get a little taste of home.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Girls are there. You can talk with them, get a donut and some coffee. I mean, it would have been a propaganda disaster in the middle of World War II to make a big deal about the fact that the guy who created the USO was actually a Nazi financial front man. And by the way, just another aside, this is why the Bushes ended up in Texas. That's why George Herbert Walker Bush came to Texas, and then George W. Bush came to Texas, because people in Connecticut, they knew all this, and they knew they'd never get elected dog catcher in Connecticut, so they came down to Texas and spent a lot of money, cozied up to the oil men, got involved in the oil business, and now they go around talking and like they're Texans. They're no more Texans than I'm a New Yorker. They're Yankee carpetbaggers.
What a story. Take some time. Tell me about the secrets of Redgate. A great story.
Well, that was one of the most fascinating stories I ever worked on. I was approached by a woman who had some health problems and had gone to hypnosis therapy. And under hypnosis, it came out that when she was a little girl, about 8 years old or so, in growing up in Montana, near a little place called Deer Lodge, that she would go out of her house and go out in the fields and go into the woods and meet with her little gray friends. And so she became really fascinated with what is this all about. And then what really got her was she had no conscious memory of that. But when she called her brother and said, you know, do you remember anything about going in the woods and meeting our little gray friends? And he said, yeah, sure. What's the matter? You don't remember that? You're the one that hogged the conversation. And so it was amazing. So based on that, we took a film crew and we went to Deer Lodge, which is located to the southwest of Helena. Beautiful little place. It's in a valley. There's mountains on either side. And up in the mountains on the east side was kind of a campground and a favorite parking place for the teenagers. And at one point, it had a big wooden gate that led in with a little dirt road that would go back in there. And all the teenagers, when they want to go park, that's where they go parking. And at one point, that gate was painted red. So that's where the name Red Gate came from. And it just kind of pertains to that area up there. But as I began to look into it, I found out that Montana has just been a hotbed of UFO activity. For example, back in August of 1950, a guy was taking films of a baseball game, and he took 60-millimeter film of these two silver circular UFOs that were flying over the stadium. And then we had there was other cases. For example, in 1967 at Malmstrom Air Force Base, a glowing red UFO was sighted by airmen outside the main gate, and within seconds all 10 of their Minuteman missiles were disabled and became inactive. So the whole area up there has kind of been a hotbed all along. And so we took a camera crew and we went to Deer Lodge, and she got in touch with some of her old high school friends. And once we set them down and assured them that we weren't there to cause trouble or to make judgments, they all started telling their own little stories. And some of them were absolutely amazing. But let me tell you, George, one of the most amazing things of that whole thing, even the sheriff told us, yes, he was aware of Deer Lodge up there because he was always getting reports of UFO activity. But the most amazing thing was to try to verify and to try to substantiate these stories, we subjected some of these stories to remote viewing. Also a lie detector test, and everybody passed the lie detector test. And then we even used some voice stress analysis. And then we even went to some remote viewers to find out, what's going on. And we did a triple blind remote viewing experiment, meaning that there was a tasker who knew what the target was. And the target was, our question was, you know, what happened to the children at Deer Lodge, and gave the, you know, location back in 1952 or whenever it was. That was the question. We want to know what happened to these kids. But then the tasker reduced that question to simply a coordinate number. And I think you and most of your listeners are fairly familiar with remote viewing. So here was just a number. The number really basically was meaningless, except it was connected and referred to the question, which was that what happened to the kids. This number was passed along to an administrator who had no idea what the target was. He just had the number. He passed it along to a monitor who had no idea what the question was. He just had the number, and he passed it along to about seven or eight of the viewers that we had lined up, and they were in different cities and all across the country. And when they came back, we said, okay, the coordinate number, whatever, you know, what did you learn about this target? Eight of them, all eight remote viewers, described young kids entering woods near their home to meet with very unusual humanoid creatures that were not human. Now, isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Well, that pretty well sold me.
And they all passed.
And they all passed, sure.
That is something.
And when you talk to these people, and they get very emotional, and I think a lot of them didn't remember, a lot of them didn't want to remember. And it really, for many of them, it was quite an emotional experience. One fellow who's just a great guy, just kind of a cowboy, okay? Great, great, fun-loving guy. But he get real serious about this stuff, and he goes, oh, I can't really remember, you know, I don't really know. And so we put him under hypnosis, and he told about being chased by this bright light. And about all he could remember was, is he kept saying, go faster, go faster, and then for some reason they stopped. And he remembered opening the car door, and that's all he could remember. But under hypnosis, he walked towards the craft. He was drawn up into the craft. And again, we tried to see if we could verify his story through the use of remote viewing. So we submitted to the 8 viewers the question, you know, what happened to this young man? And of course, we didn't ask him that question. We simply gave him a number and said, you know, well, what do you see at this target? And they all said, and one of them even drew a circular craft with a shaft of light with these little human stick figures being drawn up into it.
Now, that's something. Now, this is much like the Travis Walton case almost, isn't
exactly.
it? It has similarities.
Exactly. The bright beam of light and being drawn up into the craft. Yeah, very, very, a lot of similarities.
Did they ever feel threatened at all?
No, not actually. In fact, that's what's amazing. The woman's brother, who they referred to him as their little gray friends, and they said they would go out and sit
our
and
buddies
talk, and yeah, buddies, friends. They'd sit and talk with them, and I really pressed. I said, well, you know, wait a minute, were you actually talking and making sounds? And they were talking back to you, and they both of them looked a little puzzled. And they go, well, you know, actually, I don't remember their lips moving, but I understood what they were saying. I think they were in telepathic communication.
They seem like the same creatures that Whitley encountered many years ago.
Yes, these were the very stereotypic grays, okay, about 4 foot tall, big head, big dark eyes, little slit for mouth, the whole thing. So these were the obviously the grays.
You know, and I can't decide whether these grays are robots or androids or real ET beings. How about you, Jim?
Well, what I can tell you, all I can tell you is my personal opinion, but this is based on talking to a lot of experiencers and studying all the literature. For one thing, I don't think there's just one gray. I think there's several types of grays.
Yeah.
And I do think that the shorter ones, the little ones, yeah, I think these are basically kind of like organic robots or, you know, they're drones. They do what they're told to do. They have a certain amount of intelligence, but they don't seem to operate on their own. And then there are the taller grays. These seem to be a little bit higher on the ladder.
These are the ones that look like praying mantises. We'll be back with Jim Mars in just a moment with questions now from you on Coast to Coast AM. Remarkable stories from Jim Mars. In this hour, we'll take your phone calls with him next on Coast to Coast AM. Jim, what's your belief on peak oil?
I think it's phony baloney.
I do, too. I think this planet has an abundance of oil.
Well, for one thing, we've got untapped oil reserves. They found a huge thing up in Montana that stretches up into California, and I never can think of the name of it right off, but the big, huge reserve up there, and then everybody that knew about it was told to shut up. So we ain't even got that. And, of course, you know, even back in school, we were talking about what up till then had been the biggest scandal of the 20th century, which was Teapot Dome.
Yeah, that's the Bakken Formation, by the way, up there.
Yeah,
of
right.
That oil.
That's it, Bakken.
Yep.
And the Teapot Dome scandal, of course, was over the naval oil reserves out in California and the fact that some politician had been paid off and they were allowing them to drill into it. But those have never been fully tapped. And Texas, half the oil wells in Texas are capped. But that didn't mean that they're totally depleted. Just means that they get sludgy and it costs a lot to try to pump that up. But there are secondary oil recoveries available, such as steaming an oil well, that you can loosen all that up and you can make a depleted well totally regenerate and produce even more oil. But George, the basic thing is that there is even a controversy over what is oil anyway. You and I were taught it's a fossil fuel. Okay. In other words, that, dinosaurs and ferns and trees were buried under the ground and mushed and compressed for, you know, millions of years and made into this black oily oil. Okay. But let me tell you how that got started. That got started back in the 1800s when science was pretty rudimentary compared to what we know today. But they did, with the Industrial Revolution, they began to understand that oil was very important, so they got to be a big interest in it. And, of course, we know that John D. Rockefeller got hold of it all, and by the end of the 19th century had gained control virtually over the entire world's oil supply. And that's very important to understand, because he understands where these people are coming from today and want to keep pushing oil, because it's a monopoly, okay? They've got total control over it. But back then, they would study the oil, and they found organic matter in it, and that's what led them to believe that, comes from these plants and animals and everything. But there is a growing number of scientists today, particularly outside the United States, and most particularly who are not on the payroll of the large oil corporations, who are saying, you know, I don't think that's right. I think this is a hydrogen cracking process that takes place deep within the earth, and this oil seeps upwards, and it seeps into these underground caverns and into caves, and that's what creates these oil reserves. And of course, some of these caves were the homes of saber-toothed tigers and, you know, cavemen, who knows what, and that's where it picked up the organic matter. So there's a huge controversy over even what's really happening. And one of the things that really points to support the idea that it's a natural earth process is that there are reports that some of these depleted oil reserves are actually refilling. Okay. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to really push on that too hard, because George, I think you'll agree with me. We're choking ourselves to death on pollution from internal combustion in engines and from the burning of oil as a fuel. We need to go to something a little more clean.
Absolutely. And we can do that, Jim. They just don't want to.
Of course. Let me tell you a story I stumbled across in researching the rise of the Fourth Reich and what was happening in the Third Reich. Towards the end of the war, in Berlin, and most of the city was bombed out, and they were getting choked off. Germany had no oil of its own. They had to import it all from somewhere. But there was a bus that they developed in Berlin that, made use of a big wind-up spring and some magnets, and they'd put this thing in the garage at night, and they'd wind up the spring real tight, and then they'd charge up these magnets, and then the next day they would, you know, engage it, and they'd drive around, they'd disengage it, would stop, people get on, and they'd drive the bus around all around Berlin, running on a spring and magnets, and then at night put it back in the barn and recharge. We know they had electric cars back in the 20s. You tell me they can't make a good, decent electric car today? Of course they can. The problem is that the people who want to try to control us owe their power to their wealth, and their wealth is based on the monopoly they have over gas and oil.
That's true.
And
let's go to the calls.
So now they're telling us there's peak oil, we're running out, and that's supposed to explain the $4 a gallon gasoline.
Let's go to our first-time caller in Nashville, Tennessee. Mike, go ahead. You're on with Jim Mars.
Yes, pleasure.
Sure thing.
All right. I just wanted to say, I don't want to come off as being the crazy guy who calls about Japanese anime, and I'm sure that a lot of people have probably called in the past about it, but you talk about Nazi propaganda, and then I know that the Nazis considered the Japanese the Aryans of the East. And I ran across an anime from the 80s, and the reason why I'm bringing this up is because they viewed in Japan as a cross, and then it was later re-released in the U.S. as Robotech Saga. It's like a 80-something-odd-long series of different different, you know, anime shows or whatnot. I'm not real big on anime, but the reason why I bring this up is because it has a very, very strong reference to something that relates to stories in the Bible, such as the Nephilim, which were, of course, the giants of old who were the descendants of gods of heaven. And the way that it starts off is that there's a ship, I guess a spaceship, that crashes on Earth. And at the time, the whole Earth is at war and whatnot. And what happens is eventually everyone comes united in the world, and they work on this ship in order to get it operational again. But the beings who are seeking the ship that crashed are humanoid. And it's very odd and strange that it kind of plays into the events that are happening today. I know I may sound off the wall, but I know that, as you're saying, the Germans were very, very adamant about gaining this technology and supposedly channeling the information. But, I mean, I just want to know what you think about that, like what the role that the Japanese were playing in this whole Nazi propaganda deal.
All right, Jim.
Well, of course, the Japanese had aligned themselves with the Nazis and vice versa, and they were part of the Axis, which was Japan and Italy and Germany, Greater Germany, which encompassed Austria and Czechoslovakia and others. It's interesting because in Japan there is a legend that that their species originated with star people, just like we have the ancient Sumerian tablets from Mesopotamia, which is now modern day Iraq, that tell of the Anunnaki, who came from the heavens to the earth and brought civilization and actually, according to these tablets, they tweaked the DNA of Earth primitives and created a worker race that they call the Adama, or the Adam, the Earth person. And let me be quick to say that they never claimed that they created anything. But what they did was improve the breed. And, hey, don't we do that today with horses and cows and sheep,
right,
dogs, cats, you know. So this isn't a big affront to the whole idea that God created anything. God creates stuff, but, hey, we tweak with it, right? And so that was the story. And I think because of the mysticism and occultism of the Nazis that they did feel like that the Japanese were in some way connected to these non-human intelligences. In fact, the U-boat, the U-234, that apparently brought two ME-262 jet fighters, 560 pounds of enriched uranium, and a scientist, Dr. Heinz Schlichter, who was invented proximity fuses, which we were lacking to make our atomic bomb work. They were all aboard the U-234, which only 6 days after the war ended, surfaced and gave up to the Americans. And on board were three Japanese officers. So apparently the Nazis originally were going to try to see if they could slip their highest technology over to Japan. But the war ended, and I guess they realized that they had a better deal if they'd swap it to us for immunity.
Absolutely. Okay, next up, Madison, Wisconsin we go. Will, you're up with us on Coast to Coast.
Yes, great show. By the way, I need to bring up an alert. Very important. There's a Hate Crimes Prevention Act of 2009. It has passed the House, and it's about to pass the Senate. If this bill passes, it means the end of free speech, free inquiry, and the First Amendment. Shows like you have will not be allowed. You will become a criminal and be placed in jail, you and Mars. This is a very dangerous act. You must look at it. Read just the lead article in Counterpunch 5709. Okay, now I've been in Germany, Russia, traveled about, and in late November, December, Russia becomes very cold. So does the Ukraine. My question is this. Who, if any one person or group, may have been behind getting Hitler to invade Russia and the Ukraine with its finest troops and with all the technology Germany had, if he had not invaded Russia and the Ukraine, would we all be speaking German?
What a great question. And by the way, sir, I totally concur with you about the hate speech bill. Anytime you start curtailing speech, you're on a slippery slope. And the thing is, I only relate the old childhood rhyme about sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. Okay? That may infuriate you. They may be unpopular. They may be uncouth. They may be uncalled for. But to try to pass laws as to what you can say and what you cannot say is just, that's tyranny. That's all it is. Now, back to your question. It's a very, very good question. I wondered this all my life, being a lay historian student of World War II. Why did Hitler suddenly attack Russia on June the 22nd, 1941, with his Operation Barbarossa, when he had not completely defeated England? And yet, in Mein Kampf, Hitler went to great lengths to say, because of his experience in World War One, he said, we must never get involved in a two-front war again, because Germany sits right in the middle of Europe, and you fight the Russians on one side and the Allies and Britain on the other, you can get squeezed in pretty quick. And so why did he do that? Well, this is absolutely amazing, folks. And if you'll read my book, The Rise of the Fourth Reich, you'll read all the details. It was a preemptive strike.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Thanks to information that is now coming out of Russia, thanks to the collapse of communism, we now know that Stalin had massed troops and tanks on his western border and was prepared to militarily invade Europe in July of 1941. He had 22,000 tanks, some of them the very heavy KV models and even a lot of the new T-34s, which for a long time was one of the best tanks in the world. Now, to oppose him, the only force that could possibly oppose him was the German army. They had 3,600 tanks, and most of those were the very lightweight PK2s and 3s. Okay? So, if you're about to get jumped by a much superior force, what's one of the only strategic options you have? A preemptive strike. You hit them before they can hit you. And that's what Hitler did. And that's why, by the way, this explains something else I never understood. I mean, the Russians had all this mass of men and material. Why was it that the German panzers were able to just punch right through them and in the opening days of Barbarossa and circle around and just trap whole divisions and whole armies? It was because, according to these documents now coming out of Russia, they were getting ready to invade Europe, and they were in offensive positions, not defensive positions. But if you want further confirmation, just consider what Hitler himself said to the German people in December 1941, and I'm quoting, "Only a blind person could fail to see that a military buildup of unique historical dimensions was being carried out. I may see this today. If the wave of more than 20,000 tanks, hundreds of divisions, tens of thousands of artillery pieces, along with more than 10,000 airplanes, had not been kept from being set into motion against the Reich, Europe would have been lost." Whoa, that's kind of a whole new wrinkle, isn't it?
Sure is. Next up, Grand Junction, Colorado, west of the Rockies. It's you, Jim. Go ahead.
Yes. Hi, Jim.
Howdy.
To talk about what you were talking about in Montana, to relate this story, my neighbor is an old rancher that moved in here about 9 years ago, and he told me a story one day about how they all went to the drive-in somewhere around Deer Lodge, and it must have been about 1959 or 1960 because his kids are all in their 50s. But, you know, like before the drive-in starts, why, the kids were all playing on swings and slides and things around
right,
the area.
They used to have little play areas there for the kids because because you'd get there right before nightfall, and it gave him something to do.
Yeah. Well, anyway, he said all of a sudden, while here pops up this big flying saucer right up over the screen and everything before the show even started. And he said, boy, it cleared that whole place.
They all left?
Yeah, he said, we gathered up our kids and we were scared to death and we left, you know.
What a great story. Another Deer Lodge story. Thank you very much.
They're everywhere, Jimmy. Let's go to Boise, Idaho. Hello, Roland. Take it away.
Hi, thank you, George, for taking
sure.
my call.
Absolutely.
Jim, we've met a few times down at the Laughlin event in March. In fact, this past year, I gave you a $5 note from the Kennedy year.
Right, one of those red inked United States notes that most people don't realize that. But in June 1963, Kennedy ordered about $4 billion of currency issued not through the Federal Reserve System that we have to pay interest to.
Interest-free.
But through the Treasury Department. It was interest-free money, right?
That's right. That's what got Lincoln killed with his greenback, too, right?
I know. Isn't that amazing? The two U.S. presidents who tried to issue interest-free money both get shot in the head in public. I don't know about you, but I don't think that's just a coincidence.
Jim, my question concerns the Kennedy assassination, and I've got a digitally remastered copy of the Zapruder film, which extends clear out to the Sprocket area.
Right. Yes, and, I've seen that.
And that's excellent quality. And one of the things I have a question about is that when the moment of the impact of the second shot, when it looks like it hits him from below, and basically the whole top of his skull back, it goes upward. The brain material is going upward and backwards. And here's my question to you. Could the Lincoln that they were driving in been installed with a pneumatic weapon? Because Johnson had that Lincoln destroyed immediately afterward, and that was an important piece of crime scene evidence.
Well, I'll let you answer that, Jim, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Final segment here with Jim Mars and your phone calls as well. Do you think President Obama might do anything to bring back some of this high-tech technology we've been talking about, Jim?
Well, I happen to know that there is a movement afoot of very credible people and scientists and engineers who are encouraging to do that very same thing. But the problem is, he's not Obama. As far as I know, he's a pretty well-educated, thoughtful person. The problem is the people behind Obama.
Mm-hmm.
In February, his new national security advisor, General James L. Jones, at the Munich Security Conference over in Europe, came right out and said that, I take my daily orders from Henry Kissinger.
Oh, my
well,
goodness.
Wait a minute. I don't remember voting for Henry Kissinger. And, of course, I don't need to remind your listeners that Henry Kissinger is the architect of our foreign policy over the past 30 years. It's gotten us into the mess that we're now. So, you know, and his whole cabinet is chock full of Council on Foreign Relations members, the same organization, the same bunch of Wall Street people and big industrialists that were behind George W. Bush. So I keep wondering, where's the change?
Where's the change? Next up, let's go to Washington. Tony, you're up with us. Go ahead, Tony.
Yeah, George, I was wondering if you could do us a favor. When Jim was talking about the European banking families that were supporting the Nazis, there was about 30 seconds that was bleeped on our station.
Oh, you're
but,
kidding me. Okay,
no,
we'll get that back again.
I wanted to. You had a guest on that saying that the B-2 had an anti-gravity mode, and I guess my main question to Jim is, what can we do to stop these people?
Well, I hate to quote Nancy Reagan, but just say no. Number one. There are now a number of states that are passing legislation. For example, I believe it's Montana that has actually passed a law in that state that says they will not adhere to federal firearms regulations. We need to go back and regain control at the local level, and we need to go back to being a free and democratic republic instead of the super Reich or the empire that we've become. Another good thing I think to do was there's a movement afoot that says fire Congress, okay? And I think that one thing we could do is the next election, you have a chance, go up there and vote whoever's in office out of office, okay? Now, I realize we may lose some good people, we may be tossing out the baby with the wash water, but by golly, that would certainly send a message. And if you do have a good congressman or a good senator, then go ahead and vote him out, and then the next election, vote him back in, okay? But that would certainly send a message that, as the newscaster said in that movie, we're mad as hell and we're not going to take this anymore.
Howard Beale. One of my favorite scenes. By the way, the call before the break wanted to know if a pneumatic weapon might have been installed in the presidential limousine that Kennedy was in.
Okay. I hate to categorically just say no, that's impossible, because, I mean, let's face it, I guess anything's possible.
Anything's possible.
But personally, I seriously doubt that, and I'll tell you why. First off, that car, that presidential limousine, was shipped all over the place and flown in aircraft, and there were lots of different people handling it and going over it, and every time they'd land somewhere, a bunch of Secret Service people would be going over it. And I think to try to use something like that would have been entirely too chancy. After all, whoever was behind the assassination of President Kennedy, they had to make double sure that he did not survive Dealey Plaza, because if he had, just think about it, he would have never stopped until he uncovered everybody involved, okay? So to my way of thinking, I think all the shots came from outside the car. But to explain this explosive nature of the headshot, and all you have to do is look at the Zapruder film, and it's quite obvious that there was just, you know, they quite literally blew his brains out. And this doesn't happen with just your normal bullet. So I think that they were using dumb bullets, or, you know, James Files, a controversial figure who's in prison still alive and claims to have been the Grassy Knoll gunman. He told that he had special bullets made with mercury in the tips, which of course would create an explosive force when upon impact. And I think something like that may have been used, and this is why that there was a very obvious explosive impact on the right side of his head. And as the caller said, this threw blood and brain water all over the place, but predominantly the heavier pieces all went to the rear, which of course indicates a shot from the front.
Want to give us a 30-second recap on those bankers again for Tony, who lost it on his station?
The people who were supporting Hitler?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, going back to 1931, it was John J. McCloy, head of National Citibank, which is now Citicorp, and J.P. Morgan, and they began to withdraw loans from Germany and withhold them, and this caused the German economy to collapse. They went into hyperinflation. And then, of course, the panicked the German public and pushed them right into the arms of Hitler and the Nazis, which was the plan, because these world controllers, these wealthy elitists who had created communism in Russia, had grown fearful because it looked like that communism was going to spread worldwide. There were strong communist parties in France and Italy and England and, yes, even in America. And they were all going, you know, raising their fists and saying, workers of the world unite. Well, this has struck fear in the hearts of these capitalists on Wall Street, so they created National Socialism in Germany. And the National Socialist platform was very little different from the Communist Manifesto. The difference was that by the virtue of its very name, National Socialism could be held within national boundaries, and so they expected Germany to be a bulwark against the spread of communism. And this is why Hitler, as we talked about earlier, apparently launched a preemptive strike in June of 1941 to stop a Russian invasion of Europe. But then they realized they had created another Frankenstein monster because Hitler and the Germans were a little bit too efficient, and they were pouring into Russia. They had conquered France and the Low Countries, and Britain was on its knees, and so all of a sudden they were faced with worldwide national socialism, and, well, they didn't want that either. So that's when they had to turn around and pull together all these nations to try to stop Hitler, which, of course, we did. It's a totally amazing thing, and yet at the top of this little pyramid, we find some of the same familiar names. U.S. corporations that were totally supporting Hitler included Standard Oil in New Jersey, J.P. Morgan, Brown Brothers Harriman, GAF, IBM, ITT, Ford, General Motors, U.S. Steel. Let's take IBM. If it hadn't been for the punch cards that were produced by IBM specifically for Nazi Germany, they wouldn't have been able to use their early-day computers, and they wouldn't have been able to so efficiently round up the Jews and the gay people and everybody else that they rounded up in the concentration camps. Yeah,
that was a low-tech version of data processing then, wasn't it?
It absolutely was. Yeah, in fact, when I was in college, I took a computer course, and it was a mess because you had to have all these, a whole handful of punch cards and feed it into that thing, you know. We've come a long way technologically wise, and of course we've already touched on the aspect of where'd all this technology come from, and a lot of it seems to have come from ET technology.
Okay, let's take some more calls here. Jacksonville, Florida, Jake, you're up with us. Hey, Jake.
Thank you very much for having me
on.
I appreciate it. I love your guest. He's great. He has really good insight on the whole JFK thing. I think he's right on it. And the only thing I want to ask is, or actually I want to make a comment first. I think that God and Jesus is the most important thing, and that JFK was all about that, and that's why they came after him, because he was standing up what was right for the people and what was good, and he wanted to start spreading the goodness throughout the country, and that's why they came after him. And
I agree with you.
I mean, it says in the Bible that if you stand up for God, the evil people will come after you. And I think that's exactly what happened, is he was a standpoint in what was right, and they came after him. And I think I wasn't even born then, but I think that, like, he was the most important president of our history because of what he was about. And I don't know if you saw this, but he had if you go on the internet, it's all over there. If you look up old speeches that he had a speech right before he was assassinated. I think it was in San Antonio or one of the other cities, where he said that he thinks that the Soviet Union and the U.S. should have a joint mission to the moon, and that, you know, instead of, like, we want to go there first, he was one to have, like, a unilateral, like, country to country. So it obviously shows he was trying to bring everybody together, and that's pretty much the only thing. The only question I have was on that, and if you saw that speech, and the second question was on the shooting. I really think that the driver had something to do with it, because why would he have slowed down and do a double take on him? It looks like he was, like, making sure he was finished off. You know what I mean? Because, like, it came from the front, and if his head exploded like that, it had to have been a close impact or explosive bullet, and everybody that was in the car wasn't looking at the driver, and the two people, the governor and the lady in the middle, ducked right after the shot, like they heard something come over their head. So
how close was the grassy knoll to the shot, to the car at the time, Jim?
I've stepped it off. It was about 26 meters. Okay.
That's not far with a high speed
range. No, it's handgun range, actually. Everybody thinks Dealey Plaza is a great big huge expansive park, but actually everybody that's gone there goes, holy cow, this is just a little bitty crunched up place, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it that was really something.
All right, Jake, and what was your first quick question again?
I just wanted to know if, like, I know he seemed like he was kind of on the edge about, you know, the Secret Service, but I really think that, you know, he seems like he wants to, like, not say it was them, but it was. But I think that they had something to do with it for sure, because, like, all that leads up to it. And then I want to know if he saw that piece on the speech about the Soviet and joint mission to the moon.
Yeah, well, we've had this on the program before. And were you aware of that, Jim, that Kennedy wanted a joint relationship with the Soviets at the time?
Oh, yes. And by the way, that gets us right back to the UFOs, okay? It's absolutely incredible. On November the 12th, he issued a National Security Action Memorandum in which he ordered the head of the CIA to turn over all their UFO files to the White House because he said, we're getting ready to go into joint space exploration with the Soviets, and we have to separate the knowns from the unknowns so that they won't think that this is just a ruse to gain their defense systems information. That very same day, I got a document out of the Kennedy Library that he sent a memorandum to James Webb, who at that time was head of NASA, explaining that he expected his full cooperation because we were going into joint space exploration with the Soviets. After the incident of the U-2 shoot down over Russia, Khrushchev and Kennedy apparently had decided amongst themselves that they were going to work to try to end the Cold War. But of course, every powerful and violent faction in this country, from the anti-Castro Cubans to the Pentagon to
the KGB.
To the KGB, to the Russian military, and on into the bankers who bankrolled the defense industries and the banks that were providing all the loans for the arms races. None of them wanted any part of that. And so Kennedy just ended up right in the gun sights. But isn't that interesting? Because, you know, years ago, they came up with the theory that maybe Kennedy was killed because he was going to reveal UFO secrets and the reality of UFOs to the public. And when I first heard that, I kind of laughed. I said, oh, yeah, right. You know, that can't be true. But I'm telling you, when you go and you actually look at the totality of the evidence, if he was going into joint space exploration, and if he had demanded that the UFO files deep within the CIA and others be turned over to the White House, which would have been tantamount to making them public, you could see where MJ-12 and the keepers of the secrets said, well, this is a national security problem. We got to do something about this.
Let's go to Woodland Hills. Jackie, you're the first-time caller. Hi, Jackie.
Oh, hi. Thank you. Sure. Really enjoying the show. I'm calling on behalf of my father, who passed away a number of years ago, but he was a World War II vet. In Germany, and I remember his stories, which were really interesting, and this was when I was a kid, is that one of the favorite things a lot of the soldiers like to do, this is more like in the caves of southern Germany, maybe it was Bavaria, I can't remember that far back, but they used to sit out there at night and watch the fireballs, and these were flying saucers at the waning end of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an enjoyment. In fact, my father was a German language specialist, and actually, towards the end, he actually spoke to a couple of the scientists at the time, and they talked about going and getting out and going and giving their secrets to the Americans. This was just before Paperclip, but yeah, mm-hmm. they used to watch him. It was a great show.
Well, what did they think they were?
These were projects that they were working on themselves. There was nothing about anything from outer space, but evidently, I remember he said that Hitler wanted to create a new Rome, and they were spending incredible amounts of money trying to be the first in outer space.
Right.
So that's where they were R&D, you know, a lot of this money in R&D, and they were doing this in hidden projects, and they were doing it inside these caves so no one can see them, but they did have to fly sometime.
Right. Yeah, they all went underground. But my question is, so your father, was he a U.S. serviceman or was he German?
He was an American. And his assignment, he was a German language specialist because he did speak German at the time.
Okay.
But it might be interested sometimes on a, you know, there's not too many vets left, but George, you might want to have a show with some of those, the vets who maybe were around and in the waning years and saw
sure
the show too. It was just fascinating.
Yeah.
My father was a World War II vet. He's 86 now, Jim, but he never saw anything like that.
Well, my dad was a World War II vet also, but I remember distinctly, like the caller, when I was a young kid, my uncle was telling me he was a forward artillery observer, so he was moving out ahead of the main force of the U.S. Army, and he told me that he was driving a Jeep around in the outskirts of Berlin. Okay, long before the Russians got there, and he said then they got orders to pull back more than 100 miles, and they had to go back 100 miles and then just sit there and wait for the Russians to take Berlin. And, of course, if you've ever read about the horrific battle for Berlin, the Germans were fighting, you know, from every block, every house, and the casualties were just horrific.
It was huge.
And it was all a deal because we could have been there.
Jim, it's always riveting talking to you, my friend. Jim Mars on Coast to Coast AM. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Lottisore, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.